calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday, the first hour of our three-hour program. By the way, the third hour of our program today is going to be a best-of show. Apologies in advance. I've got to hop on a plane to go to Nevada City, and where there's a film festival, the Wet n' Wild Film Festival, is showing Crude Impact, a movie about peak oil that I'm in, and I'm giving a speech after the movie. And so I will be there in Nevada City, California tonight at 8:30. And so our third hour, I will be on an airplane. But our first hour, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, one of two independents, for a long time, the only independent in the House of Representatives, longest serving independent in the House. I think of Senator Sanders as America's senator. He's neither a Democrat nor a Republican. And I believe really represents all of us, although he's doing a marvelous job of representing the state of Vermont. Senator Sanders, Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. It's so nice to see.
In addition to being an author and a radio talk star, you're also a movie star, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
In a small way. Yeah. But it's a hoot seeing your face, you know, 6 feet high on a giant screen. It's a little intimidating, actually. They did a premiere of it in San Francisco a while ago. And anyway, Iraq. We haven't talked since the president started his so-called surge. What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously, I think it is an absurd and dangerous idea, which will only make a horrendous situation even worse. It is really quite amazing that this president has taken the November elections, where to a significant degree, the American people say, Mr. President, you're moving in the wrong direction in Iraq. He says, really? Well, I'm going to give you more of what we have done over the last 4 years. That is an extraordinary show of arrogance on the part of the president. I think also what is interesting is the response that his speech has gotten here on Capitol Hill, not only from progressives, not only from conservative Democrats, but also from an increasing number of Republicans who are very skeptical of the president's plans. Now, what's happening, there's a lot of discussion here in Congress about what we can do about it. I think what you're going to be seeing maybe as early as next week, these things change every minute, but will be a resolution, the goal of which is to try to create a bipartisan statement in which you're going to have a number of Republicans, hopefully, joining with Democrats, essentially saying, Mr. President, escalating the war is wrong. Don't do it. And if that passes in a bipartisan way, we think that should send a strong message to the president. In addition to that, and perhaps more significantly, there are a number of us, and Senator Kennedy has been active in this area, who are prepared to bring forth legislation which says, and it's an interesting point, that the war in Iraq now is not the war that the president was given authority to wage. I voted against that originally, but no one is going to sit here and saying that the war in Iraq now is to prevent Iraq from using weapons of mass destruction against the United States, right?
Right.
That was the original purpose. Well, no one is going to argue that's still the purpose. So what Kennedy is saying is that if he wants to send more troops in and he wants money to do that, he's going to have to come back to Congress for a new authority. And I'm on board that proposal. Mm-hmm. Then there's a third proposal which goes even further, and people like Senator Feingold are pushing that, and that is to begin the process of using the budget not to cut funding for our troops, but to provide funding for the troops as we bring them home. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what the president is saying is, give us money, and I don't know when the troops, 5 years, 10 years, we don't know. And what we are saying is, yeah, we're going to give you money in order to bring our troops home safely within the next, whatever, year.
Yeah.
So those are the proposals that are floating around here in terms of Iraq.
There are two you know, among the talking head theories that are out there floating around about what Bush is up to and what's going on, there are two that seem to have some cogency. One is that really what this is all about is politics, not military strategy, and the primary political strategy is to make sure that when this war does end, and in all probability the end of it will be perceived in a way not that dissimilar from Vietnam, that it happens after the next president is elected. So Bush doesn't have that on his CV, that he lost a war, in quotes. The other theory is that he really wants to have a larger and wider war in the Middle East, and that this escalation and the taking of the Iranian embassy in Erbil yesterday is part of an attempt to provoke the Iranians into doing something that would justify, that would be sort of a mini Gulf of Tonkin, that would justify a hyper response by the United States. What's your take on those two theories?
Well, you're right. Those are two theories that are being seriously talked about. I can't give you a definitive answer on them, but I think that they both make sense. I mean, they both, if you bring in enough troops and you keep the action going and you keep sending out favorable press releases until you're out of office, then you can pass the buck to the next guy.
Yeah, it's just 18 months.
You know. Right, you could do that. And there is that a possibility? Yeah, I do think it's a possibility. And this business about attacking the Iranian embassy there, that is a real concern. And I think you're going to see a number of people here saying, and I think Joe Biden was very strong on this, is that you cannot take any action against Iran, against Syria, without the authority of the United States Congress, and he's not going to get it.
Yeah, although apparently he did yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's arguable whether or not this was an actual embassy. That's mm-hmm. But the Iranians are asserting that it was, and it's going to be interesting to see if this blows up. The Democrats are now in power in the Senate, in the House, and at least so long as Joe Lieberman continues to caucus with the Democrats, he's now said he's no longer asking for the documents on Hurricane Katrina, which is a little spooky. But nonetheless, the Democrats are in power. And I thought one of the most underreported stories of the last week was Ted Kennedy coming out and saying that he believes that we should have Medicare for all. But there have been, which is something I'd love to get your thoughts on, but there's also been a number of real significant accomplishments over the last few days that are also not getting covered.
Right. I mean, I think, legitimately so, the escalation of the war in Iraq is something that should be talked about. It is of huge concern to everybody. But, in fact, I think what you're beginning to see is the Democrats beginning to move on a number of important issues, such as ethics reform, such as raising the minimum wage. For 10 years, we have had the absurd situation in which the minimum wage was $5.15 an hour, the national minimum wage. The Democrats have raised that. Dealing with embryonic stem cell research is extremely important. You're going to see movement on global warming. You're going to see movement on a variety of issues. And I think you're going to see a lot of quick movement on the House side. The problem, of course, in the Senate is you need 60 votes in order to get anything substantive through. Republicans will do everything they can to oppose any type of legislation which impacts on large corporations or the wealthy. That is what they do. So we're going to do the best that we can here in the Senate. I was at the hearing where Senator Kennedy was talking about universal health care. That's not a surprise. I mean, he's been an advocate for that for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
The real challenge that we face is within a healthcare system which is disintegrating, in which the number of uninsured is going up, in which the cost of healthcare is soaring, in which we pay the highest cost in the entire world for prescription drugs, in which we're having a very difficult time getting primary healthcare physicians out into rural areas. Dental care is a huge problem in many parts of this country, and yet we spend almost twice as much per capita as any other country on health care. So clearly we have a non-system which is disintegrating, and we need fundamental changes in that system. The question, obviously, is how do you proceed? What is the best way to go forward? I am not overly impressed by the Massachusetts plan, which kind of mandates that everybody has health insurance, kind of like we do with auto insurance. It doesn't get to the root causes of why our healthcare system is so expensive and so inefficient. I prefer a single-payer system. And what I will be, and talked about a little bit at this hearing a few days ago, is I kind of think that given the power of the drug companies, the insurance companies here on Capitol Hill, probably what would be a faster route toward a national health care program is to see if states can be given help to go and establish their own universal health care plans, learn from what they are doing, and then eventually adopt a national program. So my hope is that Vermont, in fact, will lead the country in providing quality health care for all through a state-administered single-payer system.
That would be great. That would be absolutely great. We're talking with Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders, he'll be taking your calls right after this break. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466. You can also drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com. 16 minutes past the hour.
I want the America my daddy used to know, where right was right and not political code, where leaders in D.C. still respected you and me, the America my daddy taught to me.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartmann here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Jerry in Long Island. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, with respect to this escalation of the war in Iraq, in addition to my supporting, and I think all Democratic and other lawmakers also need to be called on to support Ted Kennedy and his legislation against the funding of Bush's escalation of this war in Iraq. But in addition to that, I have this idea, and I'd like to know what the senator thinks of it. That my idea is this, that now that Congress is controlled by the Democrats, both houses of Congress, I think they should pass a new binding resolution that rescinds by October of 2007 the authority that Congress first gave Bush in October of 2002 to use military force in Iraq and go to war there in the first place. And this new resolution should require Bush to submit within 90 days from its passage a troop withdrawal plan with a clear exit strategy in it. And then Democrats can put Bush on notice that if he fails to comply with the terms of this resolution and instead continues to escalate the war in Iraq without congressional authority to do so, that he'll be violating both federal law and the U.S. Constitution in a way that's clearly impeachable and illegal. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's an interesting idea. There are a number of ways to deal with the issue. Ultimately, the president is not going to be able to not only not increase troop levels but wage a war if he doesn't have the money to do it. So the real issue is, will Congress begin the process of cutting funds for the war, stop the escalation, and develop a budget which brings the troops home? I think that's the most immediate way to address the issue. And that is something that some of us are working on right now.
Chris in Salinas, California, listening on KRXA. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Bernie.
Hi, Chris.
And Tom. Hi. Thanks so much for what you guys do. I had one question, and I want to change gears a little here. What are we hearing since you, Tom, brought up the fact that in 18 months we're going to have, I guess, the primaries coming up? What are we seeing in the Senate on election reform? And what are you hearing? And, I mean, the silence is deafening on this issue. And
on what? What issue?
Election reform.
Election reform. All right, Chris, give me some specifics. What do we mean?
Well, as far as electronic voting machines and those, I mean, we need to eliminate these machines from the process, and we need election reform over the entire country.
You mean like public funding of elections and things, Chris?
Well, no, just so our votes are being counted.
Cleaning up the system.
The answer is, yeah. As Tom and I have discussed many times, I am concerned. We're concerned about what has happened again recently in Florida. We're concerned that these touchscreen voting machines may not be accurate, and one doesn't know if they're accurate or not. And I would tend to agree with Chris that it would be a good idea to go back to paper ballots or some other form until we get this new technology down pat. Bottom line here is that voting is the bedrock of American democracy. If people cast their ballots, they need 100% knowledge and feeling that their votes are going to be accurately counted. So I share Chris's concern about that. But actually, I think equally important or more important is the question of how we fund elections. And what's going on in America, and Tom just raised this issue, is that what's going on in our country is becoming more and more expensive to run for office. It's very hard for somebody in the middle class, working class person to run for office, especially in a large state, but even in small states like Vermont. And I think we need to move toward public funding of elections. We're seeing certain states like Maine, Arizona, showing that this process can work. And we're going to be working on trying to help other states do the same thing and eventually have the United States do that. What we don't want to do is have a nation in which only wealthy people, very wealthy people, or people who represent very wealthy people have the capability of being a strong candidate. So that is a huge issue that we as a nation have got to address.
Indeed. Bob in Dearborn, Michigan, listening on WTKG, Clear Channel in Michigan.
Hi, good afternoon, Tom. Good afternoon, Senator. I heard a couple things yesterday that after hearing them, I'm starting to doubt my own intelligence. Maybe you can help me out. I heard the Secretary of State answer Chuck Hagel's question yesterday, and her answer was, we're not in the middle of two sectarian groups fighting it out. That's number one. And number two, I also heard Gordon Smith from your state, Tom, say that if we turn around and get out of there, they're going to follow us back here. Can somebody explain to me how the Sunnis and the Shiites, who are the people we're fighting, are going to follow us over here?
Good one. Bob, Bernie, you can take that on after we come back from the break.
Okay.
Great. Thanks a lot. Bob, good question. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We do have to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls at 1-866-440-THOM. We'll be right back here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Everybody's wondering whatever, where they all came from. Everybody's worried about when they're gonna go and the whole thing's down. Nobody knows for certain who is all the same to me. Think I'll just let the mystery be.
Welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. Just a quick heads up on schedule upcoming tonight at 8:30. I'll be at the Nevada Theater, Nevada City, California, the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival. I'll be giving a brief talk, and they will be screening a movie called Crude Impact, a powerful and timely story that explores the interconnection between human domination of the planet and the discovery and use of oil. It features me and is based in part on my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. January 25th and 26th, Washington, D.C., I'll be at this is the State of the Union Radio Row. I'll be at the broadcasting live from the Mayflower Hotel. And the night of January 25th, Thursday night at 7:30 at the Mayflower Hotel, open to the public, there will be a press party and public party. And I'll be giving a lecture, a talk, a rant, whatever, on Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, open to the public. And then the following week, March 1st and 2nd, I'll be back in Washington, D.C., for a radio row sponsored by the American Conservative Union Foundation. I will be the only liberal sitting there with a whole bunch of right-wing talk show hosts talking to Dick Cheney, Ann Coulter, Mike Pence, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, and others. It should be very entertaining. So we're live with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, the first hour of every Friday. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Dan in Louisville, Kentucky, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, Senator Bernie, what a pleasure to talk to you. Tom, the most brilliant person on the air, and Senator, the most insightful and brilliant person now in the Senate. I am so happy for that.
Now, having set us up, you're going to ask us a hard question.
yeah, here comes.
Here comes the butt.
Was Congress alerted to the invasion of foreign territory with the taking of the consulate in Erbil?
I was not, and I don't think that most members were.
And I know that, Tom, you said there was some question as to whether or not this was a consulate. I do believe it was. In the early reports, supposedly there were six people that were, quote-unquote, detained. Do you know if these are Iranian citizens? And would you believe, as I do, that Iran might very well see this as a declaration of war?
I think what the president did is extremely provocative. What Tom was saying a few moments ago is this could lay the groundwork for a response from Iran, and we're off and running. And this is an issue that we need more clarification about, and the president has got to be told in no uncertain terms that he cannot act in a warlike manner against Iran, against Syria, or against any other country without the authority of the United States Congress. That he's not going to get that authority.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Bernie. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, guys. Great show so far.
Thank you.
Listen, Bernie, I think Harry Reid is talking about a binding resolution to tell the president that he shouldn't go escalating troops.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a letter carrier. I've been speaking with a lot of postal workers. I set up a website and about this issue of the president opening our mail without a warrant, according to constitutional signing statement. And I wonder, since Congress has basically punted on this, said they can't do anything about it, can't they at least do a non-binding resolution?
Jeff, I don't think Congress has punted on the issue. What you have is a new Congress, which I certainly hope will not punt on it. I will not punt on it. This is one of many issues of deep concern about the president's disregard for the Constitution of the United States and the privacy rights of American individuals, individual Americans. So I would hope, by the way, that virtually all of the president's contentious decisions, which undermine our constitutional rights, are brought up, are discussed, and in fact, where the president was wrong, are revisited and the damage undone.
You know, especially the signing statements. Jeff, can you give us real quickly that website? I know I've seen it before. I'd just want our listeners to know about it for letter carriers who are concerned about this signing statement.
Thanks, Tom. And just a quick side note, I just met our new postmaster in Tacoma, and she basically parroted the Postal Service line, which is that there's nothing new here. The media blew it out of proportion.
Yeah, well, so your website is?
www.postalworkersunited.blogspot.com.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
Philip, all right, Jeff, keep up the good work.
Indeed. Philip in Baton Rouge, what he's doing right now with the postal workers is what the librarians were doing with you back in the early days.
That's right.
Philip in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Let me once again thank you two for just getting here every week and doing the spadeful by spadeful turning up of the soil of truth. I gotta say that I really enjoy pulling up to the gas station and pumping in what I need to go to work every day, and that it's a planetary concern that there be peace in Iraq. And my question to the senator is that isn't this something that the European Union, the United Nations, I know China is kicking our butts in terms of diplomacy and going over to Iran and Venezuela and signing up oil deals that are beneficial to China and the countries that they talk to?
Well, I mean, we have, as I have stated many times, if not the worst president in the history of this country, certainly one of the worst. And we can spend 10 hours talking about his failures in every single area. Certainly one of his failures has been to isolate the United States diplomatically, take a country which was immensely popular and now is a country where all over the world people look at us and shake their heads and wonder what is going on. In terms of oil, I must say to you, Philip, that I think the primary concern we have right now in terms of oil, and I guess, Tom, you're going to be speaking on this tonight, is the fact that it is absolutely imperative that we, in fact, break our dependence not only on Mideast oil but on fossil fuels. I'm on the Environmental Committee, and I'm on the Energy Committee. And my top priority, in fact, we're going to be introducing sweeping global warming legislation next week, which, if passed, will break our dependency on fossil fuel and move us in a very comprehensive way to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And I think that is something that we just have got to do. for the sake of our kids and our grandchildren, because if we don't, the planet we're going to leave them will look very, very different than the planet that we have enjoyed. In addition, while we're on oil, what we want to do is protect the needs of working people. We don't want to see gas prices going up to $3 per gallon or north of that. I think we have to take a hard look at OPEC, which is, of course, a cartel which controls the price of oil and the production of oil, and make sure that we have some free market activity over there.
Bernie, I'm just a follow-up question of mine. I'm curious if your thoughts on this. I don't think the average American probably even realizes that the minimum wage has been raised, that stem cell research ban has been lifted. I mean, the enormous things that Congress has done because of Bush's announcement of his so-called surge.
Right.
Is it possible that this is just a political strategy by Karl Rove to steal the headlines away from the Democrats?
No, I don't think.
Okay, that's paranoid on my part.
If
all right.
It is, it's a fairly stupid strategy, but you raise the point, and here's the point. You know, a lot of people have given up on government. They think, while the middle class is shrinking, while poverty is increasing, while our health care system is disintegrating, while nothing serious is happening from Washington in terms of protecting our environment or global warming, people have given up. But in fairness, there has been some steps forward. Let me just mention, right now in Congress, in the House, ethics reform has been passed. Do we need to go a lot further and move to campaign finance reform? Yes. Are we off to a good start? Yes, we are. We are moving toward implementing the recommendations of the 9/11 commissions to do everything that we can as a nation to make sure that we are not going to be attacked again and we can protect our people. The minimum wage has been raised for 10 years while the Republicans were giving hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, to large corporations. They forgot about the millions of workers who are making $5.15 an hour. The House has raised the minimum wage. That bill is coming here. We're starting work on it shortly. Stem cell research, which is an opportunity to begin to develop cures for a whole host of diseases, a proposal that President Bush vetoed last year that was passed just the other day. It will be passed, I believe, in the Senate. We'll do everything we can to prevent another presidential veto. There is wide understanding, especially for those of us who have or have had kids in college. Cost of college is soaring. The House passed legislation that would lower interest rates. I think we've got to go a lot further than that. My view is that every person in this country who wants a college education should be able to get one without going deeply into debt. We've got to move forward on that. And there's some action now on moving toward energy independence. So the truth of the matter is, in the House now, and the Senate is a slower body, but progress is beginning to be made to address some of the issues that for so long have been neglected by this president and Republican leadership.
Yeah, and unfortunately, all we're talking about is the surge in Iraq, and it's not even, I mean, you know, it's just a tiny percentage of troop increase, although it's still
But it's a
crazy
statement, Tom.
Yeah.
It is a statement by this president who says, I really don't care what the Iraq study group said. I don't care about what the American people said. I will do it my way, and I've been consistently wrong and will continue to be wrong.
Yeah, that's tragic. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. The lines are slammed. We'll be back to your calls as soon as we get back from this break. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. Stick around.
When this war is over, it will be the end. When this war is over, it will be the end.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, telling the truths that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. It's our Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Skyler in Carrollton, Georgia, you are live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
Good.
I just had a question for Senator Brown. I feel like this is an issue that, you know, maybe can eventually be dealt with, and I'm definitely going to switch gears with this question. But there really hasn't been any action, especially by the Republican Congress, on rights in the workplace, especially for gay and lesbian people. Now it's currently legal in the United States to discriminate in public and private employment against people on the basis of sexual orientation. I was just wondering if this Congress is going to take up an issue with that. I understand the sensitivity of the marriage issue and everything, but to me, and I think a majority of Americans, protection in the workplace is a basic right that should be established. I was just wondering, Senator Brown, if there was going to be any action.
Senator Sanders.
Yeah, well, I hope so, and I think so. People should have a right to gain employment and stay on their jobs without fear that they're going to be discriminated against based on their sexual orientation. If they can do the job, they should have the job. We went through this whole struggle with race. We went through it with gender, and now we're about to, we are going through with sexual orientation. But I would hope and believe that this is an issue that the Congress should address.
Michael in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. I'm a steady listener of your show, and I really like it.
Thank you.
And same with Bernie. My question is this. In light of Nancy Pelosi's and the Congress is passing the new ethics reform with earmarks more transparent, I was wondering what's happening in the Senate. I saw in the Wall Street Journal that Dick Durbin wants to table the amendment, and 38 Democrats went along with him. And this is their big chance to show that they want to truly have ethics reform. What's happening?
No, I think ethics reform is going to pass. I think it is going to be the strongest ethics reform since post-Watergate. And I think that the legislation, it is not accurate to say that what Reid was trying to do is torpedo not only ethics reform, but earmark reform. Bottom line is it's going to pass. It will be the strongest reform since Watergate.
Carol in Iowa, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, if Congress is going to supposedly withhold funding of additional troops as President Bush has proposed, what are you going to do about those troops that are already there that are beyond the term of their enlistment and beyond their tour of duty, their designated tour of duty? And I ask this because in our paper today, the Pentagon has extended active duty personnel for Iowa soldiers that were supposed to rotate back in April. Now they're extending them through August.
Are Is this National Guard people?
Die?
Is this National Guard people, Carol?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It is an issue of great concern. And the goal here, and what some of us are trying to do, is bring all of our troops, National Guard and active duty, home as soon as we can. And as Tom and I talked about a moment ago, probably the most effective way to do that is simply not to provide the funding to the White House to continue this war indefinitely. So, number one, we want to stop funding for an acceleration of the war, for an increase in troop numbers. Number two, we want a funding approach which brings our troops home safely within the next year, and that certainly would include the National Guard. We have many National Guards people in Vermont who have served in Iraq. In fact, in my state, I believe we have the dubious distinction of having the highest loss ratio per capita for soldiers from a state. So I am more than aware of the sacrifice the men and women in the National Guard and the Reserve have made, and we want to bring them home as soon as we can as well.
John in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders. John?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on
yes.
the air.
Okay, good. I have a question with Bernie on the Social Security. I have sent a letter to 45 senators and congressmen on the Social Security program, and I've only received two answers in the past year, one from John McCain and one from Specter of Pennsylvania. And I'm going to give you just the first paragraph of what I wrote.
Well, John, I'm sorry. We only have about a minute and a half left before the show has to wrap up.
Right.
What's the question?
Well, the question is, what are we going to do about Social Security?
Okay. Well, let me give you the brief answer. Number one, President tells you Social Security is going bankrupt. It's simply not true. Social Security can pay out every benefit to every eligible American from between 35 to 45 years. Second of all, long term, what we have to do is eliminate the cap so that Bill Gates is contributing into the system the same amount of money, so that we end that situation where Bill Gates is contributing into the system the same amount as somebody who makes $94,000 a year. If you do that, Social Security will be strong way into the future, and that is what I think we should be doing.
Yeah, it's just it's pretty straightforward.
Of all the problems facing Washington, that is not one of the complicated ones.
Yeah, this is very, very straightforward. The Bill Gates should just simply pay the same percentage as I do.
That's right.
You know, what's wrong with that? Okay, Bernie, it's been a great hour and a great week. Thanks again for being with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Taking our listeners' calls. We'll see you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Senator Bernie Sanders. It is 56 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up right after the news, we're going to talk about the Ashley case, a little bit of a change of topic, and then we're going to have an Iraq War veteran at the bottom of the hour. It's going to be, it's kind of a tear your heart out situation. Two of them, in fact. So we'll be back with this. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Just a quick heads up, the third hour of our program, which typically on Fridays the last few weeks we've been doing this, kind of writing a book online about cracking the code, the art and science of political persuasion. We will not be doing this week because we're going to be playing a best-of show for the third hour of our program. This hour is live because I have to hop on a plane to get down to Nevada City. Nevada. Yeah, there you go. City, California for this film tonight. Arlene Mayerson is with us. She is an attorney, the directing attorney of the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Arlene, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I brought up on this program a week or so ago when this story first hit the paper, the story of a young girl in a 9-year-old, I believe she is now, in Seattle, developmentally disabled, whose parents had her undergo a hysterectomy and mastectomy and gave her hormones to stunt her growth so as to keep her small as she became geologically older, or physiologically older. And put forward my belief that this was a good thing both for her and her parents. Your organization, DREDF.org, the website, the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, took strong exception to that and posted I got a letter specifically about my saying it, and posted a note over on your website, which our listeners can read. And so I thought it would be good if we had a conversation about this. Can you tell me, what's your position on this?
I think it really boils down to one simple question. Is Ashley, a 9-year-old girl, human? And if Ashley is human, then she has integrity of her body and autonomy of her body. And no one can decide that they want her shorter, that they want to stunt her growth, that they don't want her to develop into a woman. These are all natural processes that happen to every individual. And there's absolutely no debate in this case that Ashley needed any medical intervention for a medical health-related reasons. She didn't have a hysterectomy because she had cancer. She didn't have her breast bud removed because she had some kind of disease. She was given these procedures simply because she is a mentally retarded, physically disabled child. And she is not being given the most basic right, which is to grow up. And the idea that her parents and these websites call her a pillow angel, I think really epitomizes the idea that she's been objectified as something other than human, something that can be, molded into someone else's image. And she's a person. And I think that there's no question that we don't do these things to children that we consider to be humans. I think it really raises a fundamental question.
Well, we do interrupt natural processes, and we do reorganize the bodies of our children and ourselves. I mean, growing fingernails and hair, for example, a very simple example, correcting for vision, using prosthetics. My wife's grandmother was disabled with polio. I mean, there are many ways that we deal with disability.
Well, I mean, let me step backwards to say these are, if you're what you're talking about is kind of this, it's an interesting kind of reversal of all the tenets of the disability rights movement. The disability rights movement are the first to say, yes, of course, you can use prosthetics, you can use wheelchairs, you can use all the things that are available to Ashley's parents right now to help someone have a more productive, independent life. But that's very different than saying you take something away from someone, you give them massive surgeries, you do invasive surgery that's painful and that cannot be altered. For what?
I think it's
useful to go through the reasons that they're giving, and every single reason, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, the for what is that she is so profoundly retarded that she has not yet reached, at the age of 9, the developmental stage where she can sit up. And if her body remains, 70, 80, 90 pounds instead of becoming 150 pounds, she's less likely to have bed sores. It'll be easier for her to be handled and treated by her parents. And so as they age, they can continue to be care providers for her rather than having to institutionalize her.
Well,
that seems like a very humane thing.
I mean, from a logical point of view, let's go through each of those reasons. First of all, there's no doubt in anyone's mind, by the way, and I think we should just set it aside, that everyone agrees her parents love her. No question about that.
Yes.
There are people with disabilities who are normal size, who have grown to the size that they would have grown to, that join their families on vacations, that spend time in the family room with the rest of the family, that do all the things they think that these drastic measures to alter her size require. There are lots and lots of people in this situation, and one of the things I really question and feel quite concerned about is to what extent Ashley and her parents and her doctors were exposed to these people. I know from the work that we do, I work with literally hundreds of parents who are in the situation of Ashley, and they see their children as individuals with autonomy. And you know what? Reaching a developmental age to sit up doesn't necessarily follow. It doesn't necessarily say anything about the person. I mean, I know people who are my colleagues that I argue against with in court who can't sit up on
them. No, but this is not because of a physical disability. This is because of the development of her brain. I mean,
she has both physical and mental disabilities.
Right. I mean,
there's a lot of people who have both physical or mental disabilities, and they, I think that,
we're talking about
a child that
has functionally no cognitive function at all.
Well, first of all, I absolutely don't think one can say that. I mean, on one hand, they're saying, she smiles, she likes this person, she doesn't like that person, she likes this food, she doesn't like that food. She has, desires, she has things that she doesn't like, she enjoys spending time with the family. And then on the other hand, she has absolutely no cognitive, to me, it's a symbol for she is not human, because if she's a human being. She might not have the same intelligence that you or I have, but she has her own identity. She is Ashley. She's not just a embodiment of a no brain or of a low intelligence. She's Ashley. She's a person.
And so, in your opinion, her integrity as a person should be respected, even if that means she becomes institutionalized rather than remaining with her parents as they get older and it's more difficult to handle.
I think it's an absolutely false dilemma and a sad one. I mean, I've been working myself. And certainly I have many great predecessors. Myself, I've been working in the disability rights movement for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, we are living in America. Those are not the options that should be posed. I mean, to say that we either, it's such a false dilemma that's been posed. We say either we do massive surgeries that no one would choose as elective surgeries, okay? Either do we do massive surgeries.
Well, I think I would, actually.
Child, or.
Arlene, let me just challenge that point, though. If looking, just myself, if I knew that I would if I knew that my ability to be comfortable as I aged could be modified by surgery, and I had and everything else was pretty much out of my control, I would choose that. I think if I was Ashley, I would choose to go through what Ashley went through.
You don't. You know what? This is.
I know I can't know that.
False dilemma that's been put. Let me just say, it's such a false dilemma that's been posed. This idea that we're going to do these massive operations on her, massive hormone therapy, because we think she might be more comfortable. I mean, there are people a lot bigger than 5'6" that have the situation that Ashley has, that are comfortable and that are included in. They have families and they're included in things and they're not uncomfortable. You know. It's a false dilemma that's been posed, and to say that let's do this to the person because otherwise they might have to be institutionalized really raises the question, and I don't know how much time we have left, but I think it's a very important thing, at least from the Disability Rights Education Defense Fund point of view, is not to just look at this as like one sensationalized story, but to look at it as an opportunity to really examine, well, what is available to help parents? And, you know, we're the first ones. We represent hundreds and hundreds of parents. We're the first ones to say, absolutely, there needs to be more support.
So you're saying, yeah, well, the point of your article was fix the system, not the person, but it
right.
raises the question.
Right. I mean, this is not just one sensational story. This is a situation where people, you know, yes, most people love their children, and most people love their disabled children, and most people with severely disabled children do need assistance and do need supports. But to say, well, and I think this family actually has the resources to get those, but to say, well, let's not go there, but let's start talking about how we can alter the person, severely alter the person. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, one thing here or there. For instance, let me just give you two examples.
Arlene, we have to take a break. You want to stick around and take a couple calls from our listeners?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you. We're talking with Arlene Mayerson. She's the directing attorney for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, DREDF.org. If you want to read their statement on the Ashley case, it's over at their website. Our number, 866-440-8466. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the True People's Radio, 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We're talking with Arlene Mayerson, the directing attorney for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, DREDF.org. Arlene, we have a couple of callers. We didn't establish any kind of ground rules with you in the beginning that, you know, I'm asking our callers not to beat up on you or whatever, if that's, that's okay. But, before I go to the calls, and we only have, I think about 5 minutes in the segment, but, it seems to me that there is a parallel in the two sides of this argument with the abortion argument. And that is that in the abortion argument, there are some folks who say it's from the moment of conception, from the moment of fertilization, it's now a person, period, end of discussion. In other words, it's a totally black and white thing versus the folks who see shades of gray, which is the official and legal position of the United States, that at least up until the point of viability, it's the choice of the mother whether or not to abort. And past the point of viability, it becomes an issue that the state can interfere with. Isn't there an argument to be made that there's a threshold, a cognitive threshold, where the rights of the parents might supersede those of the child?
Well, that's a great segue back to what I said as my very first sentence. I think the question is, right here, is Ashley human? And if you answer the question yes, then you have to be against everything that's happened. If you answer the question no, then I think, you know, if she's not human, then yes, you know, you can do all kinds of things with her because she's not human. But if she is human, and if people with severe cognitive disabilities are human, then they have human dignity, human autonomy, and human integrity.
Okay. Linda in Madison, Wisconsin, you're live with Arlene Mayerson.
Hello.
Hello, Linda.
Hi. I'm a mother. I'm 60 years old. I've got two daughters, one natural, she's 30, and one 17 that I adopted. They're both severely MR. They both have trachs. They both are G-tube fed. Jody's rated at about 3 months. Rachel's probably at around 4 months. I'm also a nurse, and I work at Central Wisconsin Center for DD. We've had residents out there raped and pregnant. My daughters are both 70 pounds. I'm only 110 pounds myself. My kids are both very small, and no, I have not gotten them fixed. Would I love to, but it's against the law here. But my question is, who's going to take care of these girls when they're pregnant? Who's going to explain to them that you are now in labor? Who's going to take care of the baby? Who's going to protect them when I no longer can? Because something like 70% of DD are sexually and or physically abused. That's my question.
Thank you, Linda. Arlene?
I'm glad that you brought that up, because the example that I was going to use about how, you know, basically taking a shotgun to kill a flea, or what I said about no one would choose these as elective surgeries, is that, you know, we all know that there are less drastic ways to have birth control than removing someone's uterus and ovaries. I mean, that's just not a common way to have birth control is to have a hysterectomy.
Well,
and a lot of people, for a lot of reasons, and a lot of disabled people, for a lot of reasons, and other people, shouldn't get pregnant, and don't want to get pregnant. And there's ways to deal with that in a much less drastic way. But even most important, the thing that I thought was amazing about the doctors actually responding as to why they gave a hysterectomy was because they want to relieve her of the possibility of having menstrual cramps.
Sure.
They're giving a hysterectomy because of the possibility that she might have menstrual cramps. I suggest taking a couple Advil at that point, and seeing how that works first.
Let me address that. Both of my girls are on a number of medications for seizures, spasticity, and now you want me to add birth control, which is dangerous in itself. When my girls do have their menstrual period, I don't know if they're in pain or not. I have to guess. I have to give them something.
Well, you have to know. You might not know whether they're in
pain. But you don't.
For their cramps,
that's the thing.
To know that they'd be in pain from a hysterectomy.
Well, they both had spine surgery. They both have had hip surgery, muscle and tendon cutdowns. Should I have not done that because they would have been in pain?
No, but those were. I assume you did them because they were medically necessary.
Well,
we're
talking a family's right to try to keep their child home. Do you have a handicapped child?
I work with and friends with many people with disabled children who are very much like Ashley. And yes, they have kept them at home. And yes, they have to struggle and they need supports. And we are dedicated as an organization to making sure that people have the supports they need. But we do not think that you go in and medically experiment with human beings.
That's not experimentation.
Yes, it is. You said that,
it's
for instance,
protection.
You said the pill.
You are protecting your
dangerous.
Child.
I think
this is the fundamental argument. We're not going to certainly resolve it here today. But Linda, thank you very much for calling and for the you know, what you're doing with your children. Arlene, thank you so much for being with us today and coming on and discussing this with us.
Okay.
I think that we've given a lot of people a lot to think about. And
again, if anyone wants to go on our website, www.dredf.org, and I'm happy also to continue the conversation with Linda. And we're dedicated to getting the sports families need, and we're very much in
support
of the
families. We have to wrap it
up.
Thank you. 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Michael in Burlington, Vermont, listening to WTWK. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program. Michael? No, Michael. Okay, let's try... hang on just a second. I'm sorry. Let's try OMD in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, OMD.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Back on this the medical deal.
Yeah.
Follow the money on that. We have all these medical expenses, drug expenses being spent on people when they are not allowed to die. We have a right to live. We have a right to die.
So are you suggesting that because Ashley can't feed herself, that she should be allowed to expire, to die?
Look at the expense. We have people that can be helped with minimal amount of energy. Follow the money. We're killing thousands of people in Iraq, Afghanistan, and our own in Iraq. Yet we're spending all this energy with because of this drug industry, where nutritional supplements and better eating habits would counteract a whole bunch of these problems.
Yeah,
if we have a right to live, we have a right to die.
Interesting. Yeah, well, certainly we've passed that law in Oregon, although I don't think it applies specifically to this case. But, yeah, OMT, thank you very much. It's interesting. Todd in Marina, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Todd.
Hey, good morning. You know, I think that this is a very complicated issue, a lot of gray areas, and people want to make it black and white. You know, I think with the medical condition that girl has, isn't it she's got, like, the brain capacity and functions of a three-month-old?
That's correct.
And there is no possibility that she is ever going to be able to lead a productive life without the help of her parents or an institution, you know, and I think that's the real issue. And while your guest felt very strongly, you know, she wasn't in the same experience. I mean, being the friend of somebody that has a daughter like that is totally different than being in that situation yourself.
Yeah.
And how somebody would act. You know, I have a friend who they had found out when she became pregnant that her daughter would have Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big crisis within the family. They ended up getting divorced, but she had the child.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, her little baby's name's Precious, and she is Precious. I mean, she's the most loving, caring little baby. But, you know, when you see her around other children, you know, the developmental stages, you don't see her keeping up with her other children. And, you know, Down's children can live a productive life.
Yeah, no, I know one.
Yes.
Young man named Life in Germany who I've known for 20 years.
Right, and I think that's different. You know, to do something to that child who can maybe not be fully functioning as other people, but could have a job and knows happiness, sadness, could have relationships.
Yeah.
But, you know, that little girl is never going to be anything more than a three-month-old baby, and I think that...
This is where I think it comes back to the original point that I made to the attorney, to Arlene Marison, which is that it seems that the difference in worldview here between her perspective and my perspective is very similar to that in the abortion debate, which is it's black and white or are there shades of gray.
And stem cell.
And the problem, frankly, of my point of view, and apparently of yours, Todd, is that if we're going to assert there are shades of gray, then we have to figure out where they begin and end.
Right.
And then it becomes a real challenge. I mean, here you've got a child who's developmentally never going to be more than three to 6 months old. Okay. But, you know, I think that this is the appropriate thing. Arlene doesn't. What if this is a child who developmentally is never going to be more than 3 years old? I mean, that's a person who can talk.
Yeah.
Right? Not a whole lot, but, you know, and, you know, would you argue against that? I mean, at what point does it become society's business? At what point do we as a society say, okay, we're going to say, here's the rules, here's the, you know, or for that matter, I mean, and this is where you get into the scary stuff like euthanasia. At what point do you mandate societal intervention?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a tough one. I just don't, you know, this is that shades of gray thing. I don't see a clear and easy answer. Obviously, the folks, at least with DREDF, DREDF.org, do see one. Todd, thank you for the call. I got to move on. Thank you. Good to hear from you. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I think Ashley's mental capacity is irrelevant because when I look at Moshe's mental capacity and he's, you know.
Did you just say, look at Bush's mental capacity?
Well, I mean, you know, and he's got the mental capacity of Ashley. He's a very productive life.
Okay. So, all kidding aside, though, I'm sure you have a strong opinion on this, Sean.
Yeah, I do, and all of Arlene's concerns are very valid. But I think what this also comes down to is that the reason why we don't want to institutionalize our loved ones is because of the quality of the institutions that would be taking these people in this country is so atrocious still.
Yeah, and which gets back actually to Arlene's point of let's fix the institutions rather than fixing the person.
Yeah, and you know what? The reason why this is such a gray area is because there's so many agendas at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And like the caller, a couple of calls said, you know, about her leading a productive life. Well, we put too much emphasis on whether or not somebody's leading a productive life.
Yeah.
And, yeah. I mean, do they have to be productive to be a person? No.
No, it's but then the question arises, Sean, do they have to be conscious to be a person? I mean, is consciousness the thing that defines humanity, or is it simply DNA?
Well, and I mean, you know, going back to mental capacity and quality of life, you know, if we use those statistics and everything, you know, they would have euthanized Reagan 15 years before he died. So,
because of his Alzheimer's, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, although the Republicans hid him in the basement, you know, after he had completely lost it, you know, you never saw him, you know, after he lost it.
After he got reelected, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, they're very good at that. Trust me. I know. I live in Indiana.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a lot of agendas here. And when I chimed in on this a couple of days ago, I said, as long as the parents, you know, agenda is sincere and that's their true purpose of doing this.
Yeah, that it's okay with you speaking as a member of the disabled community yourself.
Yeah, and you know, somebody would have told me, look, you know, your kid's going to have 330 surgeries. Do you really want to put him through this? You know, my parents probably would have said no, but
you've had 330 surgeries?
333 to be exact.
Wow.
Yeah, and I've been independent for 15 years.
Yeah.
17.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you know, I've had a great life. I'm very fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, you know, especially in Indiana, don't have great families of disabled people. But I've got a great family, and I'm very fortunate to have what I have.
Yeah, to have the support.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Sean, thank you very much for weighing in and sharing that with us.
All right. Thank you, Tom. And look, please don't hesitate to use more disability issues than just this in the future.
Sure. I'll keep an eye out for them. And
one of your callers could be disabled, you know, within a half hour.
I know. It's there, but for the grace of God go all of us, right?
And being disabled is not necessarily the worst thing in the world. Being a Republican is... I'll talk to you
guys
later.
Thank you, Sean.
Sure.
God bless you. Grace in Napa, California. Hey, Grace.
Yes, I'm Tom. I'm on LASIK, so I'm having a time holding on this line.
I'm sorry.
I wanted to present this to you because of your common sense approach to life, and I was hoping to get this message to Bernie, too, because of the vote yesterday on stem cell research.
Mm-hmm.
I was an RN, and most people don't understand basic biology. Life begins at implantation, not conception.
Well, it depends. According to Catholic Church, it occurs at conception.
Yeah, but I had been raised Catholic. I'm not now. But whether vegetable or animal, unless a seed has a life source, it cannot grow to term.
Right.
And so those that are against embryonic stem cell research, do they have life sources for all those petri dishes? They don't want to assist God, yet they want to play God.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. And it's going to be very interesting now that that Congress has voted to lift the ban on federal funding of embryonic stem cell research to see if Bush is going to veto this one again. The only thing that he's ever vetoed in the past. And Grace, thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Well, I thank you for your ads, too.
You're welcome.
I got the Chorus Seed and HBP and
okay,
Jim Hightower. I sent for the newsletter in November, but I haven't heard, and I wonder if they're opening my mail.
You never know, Grace. You never know. But JimHightower.com is his website, so you can check it out. Thank you very much. Sarge in Columbia, Mississippi. We only have about 20, 30 seconds, Sarge.
Okay. I appreciate what your guest was saying, but let me also point her into something. If she wants to really help some children, we've got four, five, six, seven-year-old children down here in Jackson County, Mississippi, on the verge of suicide, and they need some mental health counseling bad.
This is the result of the hurricane?
Right, and they're not getting it. If she wants to really get involved with some children, let her contact me at unreportednews.net, and I'll be glad to set her up with something that will really break her heart.
Thank you, Serge. Unreportednews.net.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour. Talk Radio News should be with us after the break, I believe, from Washington, D.C. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, for a change in America. We'll be right back. Back, my friends, 9.5 minutes before the hour. By the way, at the end of the week here, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn, to Lauren Kirshner, the folks at Air America, Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, our affiliates, our sponsors, to you for listening to our program, and to the fine folks at the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, including Ellen Ratner, the big cheese there. Hey, Ellen.
Well, okay. Apparently the Inspector General is going to be testifying next week, and this is of the Interior Department, of the Interior's management of its oil and gas leasing program. The bottom line apparently is that there is going to be a report that says why the Interior Department's Mineral Management Service failed to include royalty payments provisions in some deep water leases in the Gulf of Mexico. Why am I not surprised?
Yeah, can you spell Teapot Dome? I mean, this is Albert. You know, Albert Fell got what, $310,000, I think, kickback from this thing. He was the Secretary of the Interior, and for giving the naval the rights to the Teapot Dome gas reserves that the Navy had to a friend of his. And they almost brought down the Harding administration. Why will this not bring down the Bush administration?
I have no idea, but I think it's a good start. And by the way, your ears must have been burning. I actually saw Danny Goldberg this morning, who said that he thinks you're the brightest guy in radio, and he says that Gore Vidal thinks you are the sun, the moon, the stars, the heavens, and the universe.
Oh, well, that's sweet. That's sweet. I hope you pass my best regards along to him.
I will do.
Also, haven't seen Danny
John McCain today, the ranking member, he's on the Senate Armed Services Committee. He defended the president's plan to a surge. He said that we have got to win, basically. He said he knows his colleagues disagree with that, but he said people have a right to disagree, but he said they should people should indicate what they propose to do if we withdraw and Iraq descends into chaos. Also, on the Iraq issue, the Iraq foreign minister today said that these five Iranians that were detained by U.S.-led forces in Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq were actually working in the liaison office that had a Iraqi government approval, and they are not very happy campers that the...
So was this an embassy? I mean, or a consulate? Does this fall under the law that says that what we did was invaded a sovereign nation?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. My guess is that you're a little better on this international law than I am. I usually leave that to my brother.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, I think you're absolutely right about this. You're a sovereign nation.
Yeah, and you don't take. I mean, this is the argument that we made when the Iranians took our embassy during the Carter administration, was that they had invaded us. They had committed an act of war against us. Now we didn't retaliate with a war, which was wise of Jimmy Carter. But the fact of the matter is that was the assertion we made at the time, and I think frankly that we should be. Because the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations and Optional Protocols is what it's called, and it just says consulate posts, consular districts, and embassies are inviolable. You cannot violate them. You know, they're foreign territory. It's going to be real interesting to see how this thing shakes out. What Ellen Ratner, what's your take on how Congress is going to be dealing with Bush if he decides to veto or signing statement away any of the accomplishments that they are putting forward this week?
I think there will be, I don't know that it'll go as high as a constitutional conflict, but I think it'll come very close to it.
Yeah. And another question, one of our callers earlier asked if it could be demonstrated that George, and maybe this is a question that you and I should just both speculate about, and we should really ask John Dean, you know, or somebody who's really familiar with constitutional law. But if it could be demonstrated that George W. Bush is not legally entitled to be president. In other words, if you could prove that the election in Ohio was stolen, and if you could, and the New York Times has already shown that Al Gore actually got more votes than Bush did in Florida in 2000, by any measure, no matter how you counted the ballots when they actually counted them. If you could demonstrate that he is not a legitimate president, can you reverse any of the decisions or any of the judicial appointments that he's made, or is that just, I'm assuming it's just water over the bridge, but it's an interesting theory, eh?
It's an interesting theory, but it ain't going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, the practical reality here. So what's coming up next week in the House?
Well, I'm not sure what they have on plan. There are definitely going to be many more hearings on Iraq next week. As you know, normally they wait until State of the Union. We do know that there's a $50 billion plan on Iraq that they are probably going to have to be facing. And we do know the United Nations Secretary is going to be at the White House on the 16th.
Hmm.
So.
And therefore,
it'll be interesting to see what the president says about the United Nations role in Iraq.
Yeah. Do you think that he's gonna try and bring the UN? See, my guess is he's just trying to play this thing out until he's no longer president, so it gets dropped in somebody else's lap.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And as I said, they're going to be there is going to be this $50 billion, whether it's going to become on this $100 million at this supplemental, an additional $50 to $70 billion as sort of a bridge loan for the war in Iraq. I don't know whether that's going to happen before the budget or at the budget time.
Yeah, very good. Okay.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
On Monday.
You too, Ellen. Have a great one. Coming up next week on Monday on the next Tom Hartman program, Republican Mike Huckabee, governor of Arkansas, will be with us, and Bob Borisage, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Our parting thought for you from Herbert Hoover.
We ourselves, when we entered the war, imitated the others. We created great propaganda agents. And no man dared to question our answer under that fierce organized condemnation.
Indeed. Great propaganda agencies. Look out. We'll be back next Monday. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And don't forget, activism starts with you. Tag, you're it.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
The values like decency and fair play, the values like society above economy. Is an economy here to serve society and culture? Or are you and I, as citizens of society and culture, here to serve those who own the economy or who have the largest share in the economy? A question that's been going back and forth in the United States ever since the arguments between Alexander Hamilton and James Madison in June of 1787 in the Constitutional Convention, when Hamilton got up and said, there's never been a better form of government than that of the British. We should have an elected monarchy, and the president should serve for life. And James Madison said, no, don't think so. And Alexander Hamilton basically left the Constitutional Convention with his tail between his legs, although, to his credit, he did come back and sign the document. And then writing the Federalist Papers actually promoted its implementation into law. But it's a large question. It's a large question. And we're seeing it played out now around this whole debate about whether or not people should be paid a minimum wage, whether there should even be a minimum wage. There used to be, back in England, up until the middle 19th century, there were maximum wage laws. It was illegal to pay a worker over a certain amount. This was to maintain a class of the working poor because they didn't want there to be social mobility. They didn't want there to be a middle class. So now Maybe, I don't know, Dan Gaynor is with us. He's the director of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org, the website. Hey, Dan, you think we should come back with maximum wage laws?
Absolutely not. I think the only people who are talking about that are on your side of the aisle, not ours.
I maximum wage laws for CEOs.
There's obvious huge problems with that because it just discourages people. I mean, if you want to go after people and say, oh, well, you're not worth what you're earning because you're a CEO and you've run a company into the ground, well then, you know, that's fine. But if you want to say, a CEO does a great job and makes tons of money for the people who own the business, can't earn a lot of money, well then you're saying the same thing about sports stars, singers, people in Hollywood, all sorts of people.
Do you think that somebody who's making $30 or $40 million a year is really going to be motivated by the possibility of making $50 or $60 million a year?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the reason I say that is because I'm a sports fan and I see it all the time. Players are motivated and people are motivated by, if nothing else, it's how they keep score.
So what you're pointing out is that at that level of income, we're way beyond the need for food, housing, and medical care. It becomes a game and it's a way of keeping score, as you point out. And therefore, why should we ignore the fact that we have millions, tens of millions of Americans who cannot pay the rent, buy the food, and pay for medical care because they're working for minimum wage? And you think that minimum wage floor, that protection, should be kicked out from under them, or at the very least should not be raised?
Well, the problem with minimum wage, there's so many problems with minimum wage. One of them, by making a national minimum wage, what you're doing is saying that labor in certain parts of the country where, you know, salary, everything is much lower than other parts, you're saying it should be equal. So you're mandating that in poor parts of the country, minimum wage is 7.25, and even though that may not be what employees are.
No, it's not mandating equality. It's mandating a minimum standard. It's a floor. Here in Oregon, for example, the minimum wage just went to $7.80 an hour.
Right, but Oregon is, of course, a higher cost of living. So it's at least by doing it locally, you give some control over a state whether, you know, if they think an employee ultimately is worth it. I mean, if you can mandate how much employers have to pay, you can't mandate how productive.
Oregon is not a higher cost of living state, Dan. We're not like California or New York, where you have very, very, very high, real estate prices, for example. You can still buy a decent, you know, two bedroom family home in much of Oregon for just a little over $100,000. No, but the point is that even if it were, even Mississippi or Arkansas, I think that you're suggesting that somebody should be able to live on $10,000 a year. I just don't think it can be done.
Well, not
in this day and age when health insurance costs $7,000 or $8,000 a year, and that's for young people who are healthy.
The whole concept of minimum wage is different than that. Minimum wage is exactly that, a minimum wage for minimum standards of employment. You're talking about people, in vast majority of the cases, you're talking about people who are entry-level employees, people who are the youngest workers. You're talking about people who are...
40% of our minimum wage workers in the United States, Dan, are over 25 years old.
That doesn't necessarily mean that they are very experienced. I mean, that's, you know... Saying someone's a certain age doesn't necessarily mean that.
Well, you said they're young and
they're
entry level workers. You've got people working for the minimum wage who are 60 and 70 years old. My point is that we as a society need to be saying, in my opinion, and this is what we did with the minimum wage in the beginning, is to say, if you play by the rules, this is the American dream. This is our definition of the American dream. The American definition of the American dream. If you play by the rules, if you put in your 40 hours a week, if you do your best, then you can have a home, pay for the groceries, know that you aren't going to be wiped out by illness, and put your kids, raise a family and put your kids through school. And you can't do those things on a minimum wage. That, by the way, that was the definition that Teddy Roosevelt used in 1913 when he came up with the phrase a living wage.
But see, the whole idea you're talking about is different. These are not, for most of these people, they're not living wages. 40%,
I know they're not, and I think they should be.
They're supposed to be. 40% of the people who earn minimum wage live in households with incomes of $60,000 or higher. These are, the vast majority of these people are younger workers. They are people, many of them are part-time workers. These are not supposed to be jobs that do pay. They're supposed to be entry-level opportunities for people. And when you curtail those entry-level opportunities, and this is something we do agree on, when you raise the minimum wage, you are going to cost jobs. When you do that, it makes it harder for
if you raise it to $30 an hour, raising it from $5 to $7. We have a $7.80 minimum wage here in Oregon. In fact, just went up 30 cents yesterday, day before yesterday. And we had the fifth fastest growing rate of job increases in the United States among states.
But see, that, you know, those may be totally disparate, you know, facts. That doesn't necessarily mean they're linked at all.
When this state first increased its minimum wage over the immediately, in the 3 years following that, the number of jobs increased in the state. What happened when we increased the minimum wage in Oregon was that the quality of life improved. People got it that they could live here. There was more money was injected into the bottom end of the consumer economy, and those people spend 100% of the income that they make, which stimulated economic demand, which created a demand for more jobs. That's how it works. This is economics 101, Dan.
But you can't mandate productivity. So saying somebody who may only produce $5 worth of labor or six is suddenly worth, you know, seven, nine, ten, that doesn't work.
Well, this is where we get into the question of, you know, what's $5 worth of labor? I think that it's entirely appropriate that we have things like, I remember when the first job that I had, I was 14 years old, I was working at a Henry's Hamburger, and I had to get a work permit because I was under 16 in Michigan. In order to work in the workplace, you had to get a work permit. This was something the unions pushed through because they didn't want to be competing with 14-year-olds. So, you know, I'm still in favor of that, I think, you know, for entry-level people. But as a society, we have to say, shouldn't we say that if a job is going to pay below a certain amount, it shouldn't exist? I mean, that there is a level where we say, no, you know, if somebody works, they should be paid a decent wage. I'm not even talking about a living wage here. I'm talking about a decent minimum wage.
But again, that's silly. You're trying to say that certain labor is just more valued when you're talking about the least skilled.
Obviously, there's a lot of labor that's very highly valued. Brain surgeons make more than people working at McDonald's. We're talking about the entry. We're talking about the floor.
Right. 75% of the minimum wage people are in the service industry. Okay, so you're talking about the least skilled, often the least job skilled people. You're talking about people who may not speak good English. They may not speak, they may not have any other skill sets at all. And so what you're talking about doing is pricing them out of the workplace. What's going to happen for employers who are suddenly faced with, you know, massively increased costs? In many cases, they're going to try to figure out ways to get around hiring as many people or possibly even automating certain job functions. And so then jobs go away.
Automation has always been there. There's always pressure to automate.
Right. But you raise the pressure to automate and you raise the pressure to cut jobs when you raise the cost of labor.
But history demonstrates, Dan, every time the minimum wage goes up, the consequence has been a positive one on society. I mean, we've got 70 years of experience with this.
When we want to stop people from driving, we raise the tax on gas. When we want to stop people from smoking, we raise the tax on tobacco. When we want to stop people from hiring, you raise the tax on labor. That's how it works.
Dan, working for a living so that you literally can survive is different from optionally driving or recreationally smoking. We're talking about something that has to do with the ability to live. We're not talking about a recreational activity here.
And I think driving for most people is not a recreational activity. Most people use that gas.
Actually, if they're priced out of the driving market to get to work, they'll take the bus.
Yeah. The reality here is that it's the unstated truth in a lot of these stories about the minimum wage. It's going to cost jobs, and it's going to cost jobs at the lowest skill level, and that's going to hurt people. And when you don't have minimum wage rules, everybody...
I got it, Dan. I'm sorry. We're out of time. Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org, the website, an eloquent spokesman for your side. Thanks, Dan.
I got friends with low wages. Now, one thing I've learned, when Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights. Stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions.
comes the unions missing.
And welcome back. It's Talk Radio for the rest of us. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. One of the folks over in our message board on our forum. So you go to TomHartman.com. You can get into our chat room, our live chat room. There's also a message board there with, I think there's well over 100,000 messages. It prunes constantly. There have probably been over the last 6, 8 years that we've had the thing up there, probably over a million messages. In any case, it says, Tom, this person, Captain Bebops, says, Tom never seems to mention the U.S. economy is way out of scale. The reason jobs go to India is their cost of living isn't way out of proportion like the U.S. It seems that nowadays in the U.S., everyone wants a monster home, monster car, and monster wages to pay for it all. It makes the economy spiral way out of control for no good reason. A crash would be a good correction, and a progressive government could have cushioned the fall. Interesting perspective. I've heard that. You know, this is a nice, tight summary of it. I've heard a number of people say it over the years. I remember my wife's grandmother, who lived through the Great Depression. She died at the age of 95 or 96, some 5 or 6 years ago when we were in Vermont, lucid to the very last minute, used to talk about, you know, she didn't much notice the Great Depression because she lived on a farm. She was self-sufficient and would say things like, you know, a depression would be a good thing. It would teach these young folks to you know, what's really important and that kind of thing. I'm just not willing to go there. I just don't think that more pain is what we need in order to learn how to be reasonable. There's a couple of fundamental fallacies in this argument. The first is that the United States economy is out of scale in proportion to India. India is a developing country. A third of the citizens of India have tuberculosis. Only about 10% of them are contagious. But, I mean, for example, you've got massive poverty in India. I've been there. I've worked in India. We took over a community for blind children, a leper colony. I was there with my wife and our youngest daughter, literally feeding lepers. And we took over this program, and it's amazing. Leprosy even exists when you figure out that this is something that can be cured with antibiotics. It is very expensive. It takes a lot of time. But, I mean, the Indian economy is, yes, there is a rapidly growing upper middle class, upper middle class, and very wealthy elite. And the vast majority of Indians are living in a poverty that we can't even imagine. Should we have to compete with that? No. I'm strongly of the opinion that independent nations should be defining the standard of living that they want to have in their nation, and that to a large extent they actually can define that based on the natural resources that are available to them, which includes the wisdom and size of their population. Now, size can be a plus or can be a minus, by the way. But in particular, the wisdom of their population, for example, Japan has no natural resources for all practical purposes. They can barely feed themselves. They don't have any natural energy sources. They don't have minerals. They got nothing. And yet it's a very wealthy nation. Why? Because they use their brains. They protect their economy. They say, this is the minimum standard of living that we want to have in Japan, and we're going to have it. And I think that it's incumbent upon every nation to do that. And it's incumbent upon the people of every nation to say to their leaders, we want to have a certain standard of living, and we want to define this. I mean, you look at what happened in, was it Argentina or Chile? I believe it was Chile that privatized, you know, during the Reagan years, privatized Social Security. They said, Reagan says Social Security should be privatized. George W. Bush down in Texas, he's running for Congress in 1977 on the theme of privatizing Social Security. Let's do that here in Chile. Let's see what happens. And now we can look back on it 25 years later and see that it was an absolute and utter disaster. And they're having a hell of a time putting it back together. It's very, very difficult to put back together a program once it's been handed off to the private sector. So, no, I don't think the U.S. Economy is way out of scale. The economy is actually quite massive. It doesn't take a lot. When you consider that the last couple of years of the Clinton administration, we were running a budget surplus. We were starting to pay down the mind-boggling debts of Reagan's Star of the Beast philosophy, of Reagan, Bush, and now Bush Jr., you know, eight and change trillion dollars in debt. We had actually started to pay that down. at the end of the Clinton administration. And that was just a couple of points, just a few points of taxes on the most wealthy among us. So, A, I think it's correctable. B, I think it can be corrected without a disaster and without a crash. And C, I see no reason why we should say, gee, there's other countries in the world that have a lousy standard of living, therefore we should too. I think every country should be looking around and saying, what can we do indigenously, locally, to raise our standard of living? 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls right after this. Welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. 35 minutes past the hour. I'm baffled by the bumper, but anyway, welcome back. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. 440-8466, our telephone. Oh, by the way, I wanted to mention, coming up Friday of this week, if you are listening between the hours of noon and 3 Eastern Time, or 9 a.m. and noon Pacific Time, or your local variation thereof, at this moment you are hearing our show live, and as it is 5 days a week. Today is the 2nd of January. And Friday this week, January 5th, I'll be doing our show live from noon to 3 Eastern Time from the studios of WPTT, our affiliate in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And then that evening at 7 p.m., I will be doing a book signing sponsored by Borders in Monroeville, but it's not going to be, as I recall, it will be at Borders, yeah. And then the next day, on the 6th of January, weather permitting, I will be flying to Minneapolis and doing a book signing for, again, these are both for Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book, at Magers and Quinn. That's the one that I think Magers and Quinn has it at an alternate location. You can contact the bookstore and find out where it's going to be. Magersandquinn.com is their website. And then on January 12th, I'll be in Reno, Nevada. This is the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival. It's not actually in Reno. It's nearby. I forget the city. The Wild and Scenic Film Festival.org is their website. And I'll be there because a movie that I'm in, Crude Impact, will be playing. And then on the last week of January, I'll be in Washington, D.C., the week of the State of the Union for a Radio Row. We'll be doing our program live, and there will also be a press party at the Mayflower Hotel on January 25th, where I will be speaking on my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It, which Amazon is offering 5% off on. 1-866-440-8466, Bill in Georgetown, Kentucky, listening on Sirius. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to hit something about that minimum wage thing your last guest was talking about.
Yeah.
I've got a little bit of experience. Before I drove a truck for a living, I was in the fast food and restaurant business for a dozen years.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just got this all wrong. Most of these restaurant-type places have virtually no full-time help.
Right, and the reason for that is because they don't want to be subject to the laws that protect full-time employees.
The last place that I worked for had, I think, 2 full-time hourly employees on the payroll, and I think we had close to 60 people on the schedule. And that's not, it's not how, you're not going to lose your job because the minimum wage goes up, because there are a certain number of people that are required to maintain a certain level of quality service and cleanliness in a restaurant. And the way you control your labor is not by the wages, it's by cutting people's hours. And therefore, most of those places have people on part-time, whether or not they draw full-time hours.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, in a service economy, or a service-type business, your major cost is going to be labor.
Yeah. Well, and the other reason why they keep it below 30 hours a week so that they keep people as part-time is that then they're not you can't easily come in and unionize people like that. You have a whole different set of standards with regard to how you have to treat full-time versus part-time employees in terms of benefits. You can offer benefits to your full-time employees and to your senior executives and not offer them to part-time employees. That's the primary one. And there's just a whole bunch of reasons why corporations, and Walmart is famous for this, but they're certainly not probably even the worst in the country, why they organize their work schedules so that their employees are mostly part-time rather than full-time.
Well, in all fairness to Walmart, they do pay fairly well to their people in the non-retail end of the business.
So. Sure, on the as you go up the food chain. Plus, you know, most of these organizations are paying over the minimum wage. The problem is not so much, you know, I've never seen, for example, a McDonald's or a Walmart that's actually paying at the minimum wage. It's always a little over that. But the problem is that there are a lot of actual minimum wage jobs out there. And frankly, I think that our experience in Oregon and other states that have higher minimum wages, $7, $8 an hour minimum wages, is that a higher minimum wage works. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Pam in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Good morning. First of all, I want to tell you I'm a union member, and I'm proud of that.
Good on you.
And
me too.
Thank you. There are a couple of points I'd like to make in the minimum wage conversation.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I believe if you raise the worker's salary, the chances that the profit line might go down, such as Exxon making $5 billion a quarter. If they paid more, would they only make $4.9 billion a quarter? And, you know, that's a slap in the worker's face. We make the profits for you, but you won't pay us to achieve those.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, this is not rocket science, by the way. In 1814, David Ricardo, the famous economist, wrote an article it was published as a booklet, actually. It's typically combined with others now. It's called On Labor. And then in 1816, he wrote one called On Profits. And they stand even today as, along with Adam Smith's work, as the core, and Desuet de Tracy for the French economist in the 1780s, as the core of, you know, rational conservative thought. And what Ricardo pointed out in 1816 was that profits, first of all, in 1814, he pointed out that the cost of labor is not determined by the cost of manufacturing the product. In other words, you don't pay people based on how much it costs to make a product, even though that's the myth that the conservatives want to promote. You pay people based on what you can get away with paying them, as little as possible. And that's a function not of the cost of producing the product or what you can sell a product for. That's a product of the labor market, how much labor there is relative to the demand for it, number one. And number two, he pointed out on profits in 1816 that if you can reduce your labor costs, it does not reduce the cost of the product, because the cost of the product is a function of the marketplace, not the function of the cost of labor. When Phil Knight figured out that he could make tennis shoes for less money in China than in Malaysia, and his costs went down progressively in making his tennis shoes, he didn't reduce the cost of Nikes. The cost of Nikes went up. What happened? His profit went up. So if you can reduce labor costs, what it does, and not to pick on Phil Knight, I mean, you know, he's playing the game by the rules. He's doing what you're supposed to do in our economy. I think, frankly, there should be more regulation on it, but that's a whole other thing. But the bottom line is that if you can reduce the cost of labor, you increase your profits. And you said it very, very well, Pam. I thank you for that.
The other point.
Good to hear. Oh, I'm sorry, Pam. We pushed the button too late there. Melinda in Everett, Washington. Hey, Melinda.
Hi, Tom. I called in response to the guest that you had earlier this morning.
Yes.
And he was mentioning about, like, sports stars and the millions of dollars that they make.
Yeah.
And using that as an argument with the CEOs.
Yeah.
For money motivation.
Mm-hmm.
For work. And I think that the point that he forgot to make was also that the sports stars aren't raised in a lot of money for the majority of them. They don't grow up in upper middle class, upper class environments, whereas CEOs generally come from money and get educated with money. And sports stars don't. So
yeah, it's become a bit of an aristocracy. There's another question, Melinda, that we didn't get into, and that I think is a conversation that we had in the United States in the 1930s and 1940s when the era of the robber barons was still in everybody's memory that we need to be having again, and that is, how much is too much? I mean, this is the question that Thomas Jefferson put out numerous times, where he talked about, you know, how dangerous it would be to American democracy if individual wealth or group wealth in the form of corporate wealth grew so great that the power associated with that wealth was able to manipulate a democratic government. And that would be a bad thing. And that's one of the arguments that Teddy Roosevelt made in pushing for an inheritance tax. And it's one of the arguments that Franklin Roosevelt made, and that, frankly, the Republican Dwight Eisenhower made in pushing for a 90% top tax rate for very wealthy people, saying, you know, there is a point at which you have to say to people, enough already. And at a certain level, it is a zero-sum game. As the rich get richer, the poor actually do get poorer. Yes, there is a lot of flexibility within the economy, but there is also a component of zero-sum game to it, and I think that's an important one. Melinda, thank you for the call. Ken in Ventura, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Ken, what's up?
I'm just wondering whether it would be at all possible, though it seems a Herculean task, to change the whole frame of reference and eliminate the term minimum wage and get the media and everyone else to start using the term living wage.
Right. Teddy Roosevelt's old term.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics produces these figures that everybody has started to use. The living wage, the minimum wage is not an accurate term. It's not an accurate
term.
Well,
here in Oregon, we have a state law that says if the state contracts with somebody, they have to pay a living wage. It's called prevailing wage, actually. And it's like $18-19 an hour. If a private contractor is going to build something that's paid for with state dollars. And, you know, I think that that's a healthy thing. In other words, they're saying you have to pay an amount that people can actually raise a family if you're going to expect them to work a full-time 40-hour week doing this job. Good point, Dan. Thank you. 45 minutes past the hour.
I'm in the trucker.
And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Mike in Astoria, Oregon, driving along. Hey, Mike, what's up?
I'm curious about something. The state has contracts that the inmates work with, like in the firefighting, and they do local contracts for cleanups and stuff like that.
State of Oregon.
Yes, the state of Oregon. You were talking about prevailing wage, and I had heard that term prevailing wage as far as what the contractors pay the state for the employees, you know, for the inmates that are working. And has anybody ever discovered what the inmate, it's supposed to go into inmate funds or something, but has anybody ever figured out how much money that the state has been making off of?
This is not for inmate labor. The prevailing wage law, now that I think about it, it may be a Portland or a Multnomah County law rather than a state law. I just know that there's been a lot of discussion about it here in Portland that contractors have to pay a living wage, the prevailing wage. With regard to prison labor, I don't know what the situation here in Oregon is, or for that matter, around the country. I know that it's very, very controversial. There's an enormous amount of prison labor, and there are industries where businesses have gone out of business and where a lot of people have been protesting the fact that prison labor is starting to become a major competitor in the workforce in the United States. Another great way to drive down labor costs. You know, just like with all the immigrants and just like, you know, all the H-1B visas and everything else. I mean, the corporate powers in this country are doing absolutely everything they can to drive down labor costs. And ultimately, the consequence of that is destroying the middle class, which is just fine with them as well. David, thanks for the call, Mike. David in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, David.
Tom, great to hear your voice again. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
You know, I think the answer to your book, Screwed, and what we can do about it is a massive debt forgiveness program across the globe. It's no secret that these regimes who control the financial network around the planet, you know, have been, their life sustenance comes from poverty.
Yeah.
all over the
planet.
Well,
and even just to use the example of the United States, debt is the principal instrument of enslavement in this country. People think that they're free. I had a con on the other day. He said, just look at this, look out on the street. Look at all those new cars. Look at all those houses that all those people are living in. And then you look at the average American, and they owe on their car more than it's worth. They owe on their house, you know, within 5% of its equity, and in many cases more than it's worth. And if we saw a downturn, they'd owe more than it's worth. And they have an average of over $20,000 in credit card debt. I mean, we're in chains. You know, people graduated from college, $25,000 in debt.
Exactly. Let's slam on the brakes. Let's all calm down and just kind of pan back and just see the dysfunctionality in the worthless currency that are just floating around in the air, yeah, that are not backed by precious metals, like our own money.
Yeah.
In the United States.
Yeah, the fiat currencies, yeah, like the U.S. dollar. Yeah, good point, David. It's time for us to take a deep breath and re-examine the entire structure of the system. I agree. I absolutely agree. I'm sorry. Nick in Hollywood, California. Hey, Nick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Nick. Tom, love your show. Just two things. Next time you have a guy on that says that stuff about the minimum wage damaging the economy, ask him two questions. The first question is, name one corporation where they did not hire more people because the minimum wage went up. Name one Starbucks, Taco Bell, McDonald's that actually said, we've got to cut back. And the second thing is...
Yeah, it's never happened, by the way.
Yeah.
That's my point. Every time the minimum wage has gone up, ever since the 1930s,
economic
growth is...
Name one news report that you've seen on the news where they went to a shop owner or a grocery owner or a flower shop and said, we cannot hire the driver who's going to deliver the flowers or whatever because the minimum wage went up 30 cents an hour. It's a great show and great topic. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Nick. I appreciate it. Yeah, and absolutely. And the point is, you know, if somebody can't make their business operate at a minimum wage, they have no business operating that business. Period. I mean, it's just the bottom line for me. I think it's, you know, pretty straightforward stuff. Aldous in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Aldous.
Hey, Tom. Great to hear you.
Thank you.
I'm calling to alert you to the fact that we've, across the country here, we're losing several progressive talk stations. It seems like almost every week another one's trying to be flipped. So
yeah, there have been a few. My guess is that there's going to be a few added as well, because this is a format that's making money in a lot of markets, and people, once they figure out how they can make it make money, that is, have a dedicated sales force just to progressive talk radio, more and more stations are going to be picking it up, in my opinion.
And that's excellent. But you know what? We're fighting back on the ones that are getting flipped. That's what I'm doing.
Well, that's great. And which website?
It's nonstopradio.com. I'm one of the people who helped do the Madison, Wisconsin station, flip
great.
That one back.
Yeah, I saw your website yesterday, and nonstopradio.com is great. And I got to tell you, the pressure point, and this is the message that doesn't get conveyed. People think it's all just about activism and marching in the street and having, you know, like the mock funeral like you guys did in Madison and all that. But the pressure point is the advertisers, and it's got to be a positive pressure. If you're listening to progressive talk radio, listen for those ads. Those are the people that are keeping this kind of programming on the air. Listen to the local advertisers. Contact them. Patronize them, recommend your friends to them, and let them know that you heard about them on Progressive Talk Radio. I mean, I remember, you know, a year and a half, Rush Limbaugh, his first 18 months on the air, he had no sponsors. I mean, you know, they were basically buying time. And he debuted on 50-some-odd stations. Somebody put some big bucks behind that show. And then after 18 months, I remember when it was 1988, the late 88, early 89, he was suddenly panicking. Oh, they're trying to take our station off. You need to call our sponsors, you know, help us out. And people did, and they called the sponsors, and they said, you know, I support this guy, I like what I'm hearing, and boom, off he went. The same thing is happening in Progressive Talk Radio. What's the website again, Aldous?
Well, it's nonstopradio.com. If you make the sponsors and advertisers part of the community, they will fight with you.
There you go. And that's the bottom line. Aldous, thank you so much. Nonstopradio.com, and check it out. But please understand, this is a business. And just like any other business, and businesses succeed or fail based on their economic success. And the economic success is in your hands. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back right after the news with Robert Perry, by the way, talking about Reverend Moon. It's going to be fascinating. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.